Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Just because the ruling was flawed doesn't mean the fishery absolutely must be closed.
A court ruled this morning that Southeast King salmon trawlers can go fishing after all. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 21st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaska leads the nation in drowning deaths, and while the state's cold water is a factor, so is human behavior.
Most of these happen instantaneously, so if you don't have on a life jacket, you don't have time to put one on.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Southeast Alaska trawlers will now have a summer season for king salmon after all. The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals this morning ordered a stay of an earlier lower court ruling that would have closed the fishery indefinitely. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Alaska Trawlers Association President Matt Donahoe was parked in his car when the email came through. He is rarely at a loss for words, but this news left him feeling elated and, for a moment, speechless.
Over the moon, but I'm so in shock and shaky that, just emotionally that I don't know what to think. I mean, I do know what to think. It's great news.
Back in May, the U.S. District Court of Western Washington had ruled in favor of an environmental group seeking to halt commercial trolling for king salmon in Southeast. The Wild Fish Conservancy argued that the National Marine Fisheries Service had failed to comply with the Endangered Species Act in allowing the fishery, and that a population of about 72 southern resident killer whales were suffering as a result. The lower court vacated the language authorizing trolling, effectively blocking the season, which begins on July 1st. The National Marine Fisheries Service, the State of Alaska, and the Trawlers Association asked the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals for a stay of that ruling no later than June 23rd. That the decision came 2 days early was almost as surprising as the outcome.
We were fairly certain that we were going to have a decision on the motion of the stay, but what that decision was going to be, we didn't know.
A call to the Wild Fish Conservancy has not yet been returned. Hundreds of pages of motions have been filed in the federal court since the Wild Fish Conservancy first gave notice that it intended to sue the National Marine Fisheries Service in late 2019. The Ninth Circuit's stay order, however, is only 5 pages, and among the most concise legal language of the entire case, stating, a flawed agency rule does not need to be vacated on remand, and instead may be left in place when equity demands. This is legalese for don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Having the National Marine Fisheries Service fix its language has been the crux of this case since it was filed, rather than identifying any specific harm from a relatively small fishery on the welfare of killer whales 800 miles away. It just took 3 years for the courts to spell it out.
That language has been there in front of us all along.
Deborah Lyons represents commercial fisheries on the Northern Panel of the Pacific Salmon Commission.
That just because the ruling was flawed doesn't mean the fishery absolutely must be closed, although that has been like typical court procedure that the permit has to go away if the document is flawed. But it clearly left room to make an argument that, you know, if there are extenuating circumstances, you don't just close a fishery reflexively.
Those extenuating circumstances involve a 40% loss in income for the roughly 800 permit holders who would put out their hooks on July 1st. The total harvest for commercial trawlers this season is 149,000 kings. Not a large take compared to other Alaska salmon fisheries like Bristol Bay sockeye, But the kings are incredibly valuable and central to the Southeast Alaska identity and lifestyle for over a century. Lyons believes salmon trollers, who are sometimes confused with trawlers, an altogether different kind of industry, were slow to tell this story.
And I think a lot of people just assumed, well, you're guilty. You're catching fish the whales need. You should go out of work. You know, it was that simple in people's minds. They did not understand the tiny amount of fish that we were catching. You know, the amount of scrutiny we're under. And we made not a great case defending ourselves on that front.
There was consistent support for trollers across the region as the case progressed. Alaska's congressional delegation weighed in with an amicus brief, and just last week, so did the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. They're our first line, said Lyons. That's our food source in rural communities. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang had praise for the State Department of Law, but he also believes that it took a group effort to win the stay.
I'm incredibly proud of the coalition that gathered together to get people in line and supportive of the appeal, and I'm certainly happy that Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed with us.
Winning the stay doesn't necessarily mean winning the appeal. There is still much work to be done, both at the agency level and in the courts. In the meantime, Vincent Lang says trollers can return to their work.
We will open the fishery on July 1st.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
One of the Alaska National Guard's highest-ranking officers was arrested over the weekend in Anchorage and charged with domestic violence assault for the second time since November. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
Wayne Don was promoted in 2021 to Brigadier General in the Alaska National Guard and was in charge of the Guard's joint staff. At the time, the Guard highlighted that he had become its highest-ranking Alaska Native member. In November, Anchorage police responded to a report of domestic violence at Don's wife's home. According to a charging document, Don's wife told police they had argued, he was drinking, and that he had grabbed her by the wrist and hair. Police saw a red mark on her wrist, found holes in a wall and a bedroom door, and smelled alcohol on him. Police arrested Don and charged him with misdemeanor assault for domestic violence and a misdemeanor for property damage. In April, the parties made a deal. If Don pleaded no contest to the property damage charge, the prosecutors would drop the domestic violence assault charge. Don would also have to refrain from drinking alcohol for 6 months and complete a treatment program, attend counseling sessions monthly, avoid contact with his wife, and avoid any other criminal charges. If it had gone smoothly, he would have been sentenced in October. It didn't go smoothly. This past Sunday, police again arrested Don at his wife's home. According to charges in that case, he was drinking and assaulted his wife again. He is charged with domestic violence assault and violating conditions of release. The charges say police came because Don was threatening suicide and blaming his wife for losing a career. Civilian criminal convictions can lead to military officers losing their posts. Alaska National Guard spokesman Alan Brown said in an email that Don was removed from his authority and put on administrative status back in November, pending resolution of his initial charges. Brown said the Guard is cooperating with civilian authorities. Brown said an investigation is also ongoing within the military. He said the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army is responsible for handling that. Don's attorney could not immediately be reached for comment on Wednesday. Online records show that Don posted a $300 bond on Wednesday and is not in custody. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
And a quick note, if you are in crisis, remember, you can call 988. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, voting has begun for the Alaska Artistic License Plate Competition.
Part of the whole beauty of the program is the visibility of the plate and seeing it and, you know, the art and celebrating the art on a moving vehicle.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by SNAP.
Two Kotzebue residents are charged with murder in the stabbing death of a 33-year-old Kotzebue man. Police arrested 29-year-old Calvin Stein and 30-year-old Audrey Booth last Thursday for allegedly killing Franklin Richards, the father of Booth's children, according to a charging document filed in the case. The charges say an unknown woman called emergency dispatch at about 4:30 p.m. Wednesday to report that someone was bleeding at an address on 3rd Avenue. The Kotzebue Fire Department responded to the address and requested police assistance. At the scene, police say they found the injured man with multiple knife wounds, as well as the two suspects, Booth and Stein. Richards, who went by the nickname Papa, was transported to Manilik Health Center and later pronounced dead. According to the charges, which say all three had been drinking, a fight ensued after Richards accused Booth and Stein of having an affair. The charges say the three grappled over a knife and Richards received three stab wounds to the neck, chest, and upper back. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito accepted a 2008 trip to a luxury fishing lodge in Alaska from two wealthy Republican donors, one of whom repeatedly had interests before the court. That's according to the nonprofit investigative journalism organization ProPublica, which also reported that the conservative jurist did not disclose the trip on his financial disclosure that year. Alito's three-day stay at the King Salmon Lodge next to Katmai National Park and Preserve in southwest Alaska was paid for by another wealthy donor, Robin Arkley, the owner of a mortgage company then based in California. ProPublica reported that Leonard Leo, then a leader of the conservative legal group the Federalist Society, helped make arrangements for the trip, including securing a spot for Alito aboard Paul Singer's jet, which would have cost Alito at least $100,000 if he had chartered the jet himself. Alito said ProPublica's report was misleading. Alaska leads the nation in drowning deaths. The state's cold water is a factor, but so is human behavior. According to a report from the Alaska Division of Epidemiology, nearly 9 of 10 Alaskans who drowned in non-occupational settings were not wearing a life jacket. And more than 1 in 3 drownings were known or suspected to have involved alcohol use. That state data was from 2016 to 2021, and federal data show that in 2021, Alaska had an age-adjusted rate of 4.4 drowning deaths per 100,000 residents, which was at least twice as many as almost every other state. The Alaska Office of Boating Safety is working to put a dent in those numbers. Education coordinator Annie Grenier says that includes boating safety classes and their Kids Don't Float program, which provides free-to-use life jackets at places people access water, as well as a new initiative with Alaska breweries called Save It for the Shore. Grenier says the state has a long way to go toward decreasing drowning deaths.
You know, anytime you're talking about loss of life, that's a family member, that's a friend, that's, you know, if we still have one person, that's too many. So yeah, it's definitely it is a problem in Alaska, again, statistically speaking, compared to other states. And we do have very cold water, and that is one of the largest contributing factors. If you were kayaking in Florida and you flip your kayak and you're a pretty confident swimmer, if anything, it probably feels refreshing. You just swim back to your boat and you get back in it. But here, because of the physiological effects of cold water immersion, it doesn't really matter if you're a good swimmer. If you're not wearing a life jacket, it's really difficult to overcome those initial reactions that we have. And that's one of the reasons that we have such a high drowning rate in Alaska.
And then there are other risk factors, right? Things that are associated with the drowning deaths. And you know, you look at those data points. What are some of those things? You already mentioned PFDs. Maybe we could just start with that.
Yeah. So again, going back to some of these reactions that we have to a cold water immersion event, we have to have on a life jacket if we want to give ourselves a good chance of surviving that. Life jackets have come a really long way. There's a lot of options now. They're a lot more comfortable. There's a lot more options, even as far as sizing, not just style. We have primarily sudden onset emergencies, speaking on the non-commercial boating. And what I mean by that is most of our incidents that lead to fatalities are capsizes, people falling overboard, ejections, swamping. Most of these happen instantaneously. So if you don't have on a life jacket, you don't have time to put one on between the start of the emergency and the time your body hits the water. So we have to wear those life jackets all the time. another contributing factor. Alcohol has been a contributing factor that we know of in 37% of the boating fatalities over the last 30 years. We know that it hasn't been a factor in about 30% of those fatalities. And then there's a big area that we're pretty unsure of. So that number could actually be quite a bit higher. Alcohol and boating does not pair well together. It affects your balance. It affects your judgment. It makes you more likely to end up in the water, and then it makes it more difficult to survive that event once you're in the water. So we are partnering with breweries across the state coming up here for the 4th of July weekend. We're running a campaign called Save It for the Shore. The breweries are going to help us promote that message that drinking and boating just don't mix and that we want to recreate responsibly while we're out there. So we're pretty excited about that. We have over 30 breweries across the state who are going to help us kind of promote that messaging. So that'll be great to see.
You mentioned that if you're drinking out on the water, that it can contribute to you maybe losing your balance and ending up in the water. But then you also said, you know, surviving that incident might be more difficult if you have alcohol in your system. How is that?
So one of the things that our body does to protect itself in the event of a cold water immersion is we experience something called vasoconstriction. And because our body's doing this, even in really cold water, it's going to take at least 30 minutes before our core body temperature will even start to drop. So if we have on a life jacket, we have a lot longer to survive in the water than a lot of people, I think, assume. The problem with alcohol is it's a vasodilator, and so it doesn't allow your body to go through this process of vasoconstriction, and so that those blood vessels are going to stay up on the surface of your skin where they're going to cool, and they're going to keep circulating through your body back to your vital organs, back to your heart, where it's going to cool more rapidly and ultimately decrease your survival time.
It seems like, you know, there's the Kids Don't Float program, and that puts life jackets at places like boat launches and provides people with those actual PFDs to wear. But then it seems like so much of it is about education and trying to just get information out to people. And then they've got to have their own personal responsibility around that. And like you said, I mean, these numbers have been high for a long time. And so do you ever get frustrated that people are not like exercising that personal decision-making or that personal responsibility that they would need to keep themselves alive?
Yeah, we, you know, the Kids Don't Float program, the Life Jacket Learner Board program, there are 36 confirmed saves is the way that we like to phrase it. So 36 people who went into the water who were wearing a life jacket because they borrowed one from the Kids Don't Float Life Jacket Learner Board and who otherwise wouldn't have had one. And so that's pretty encouraging. I like to think that number is actually quite a bit higher. We just haven't heard those stories. But, you know, of the people that we have heard from, I mean, 36 people, again, that's, you're talking about people's kids, their parents. It's not just kids' life jackets out on those boards. It's adult life jackets, too. Family members, friends. That's huge that we know that those people are still here because they had a life jacket. And so we know that program works. You know, it takes a lot of time, a lot of coordination getting those life jackets all over the state every year, but we wholeheartedly believe that it's working and that's saving lives.
For more information about boating safety or classes on safely accessing Alaska's many waterways, check out dnr.alaska.gov/parks/boating.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from oversized equipment to small packages for commercial or residential. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game recently killed over 100 predators as part of control measures aimed at growing the Mulchatna caribou herd in southwest Alaska. The herd has declined over tenfold in the past 25 years, affecting subsistence hunters throughout the region. But as KDLG's Christina McDermott reports, research suggests that disease and lack of nutrition, not predation, are largely driving this decline.
The Mulchatna caribou herd was once among the largest in Alaska, with a historic range spanning from Dillingham to Bethel to Lake Iliamna. Today, the herd has dwindled to roughly 12,000, well below what the Alaska Department of Fish and Game consider a healthy size. Biologist Christy Hune is a representative for the conservation group Defenders of Wildlife. She says an ongoing study conducted by Fish and Game presented two major contributing factors for the herd's decline last year.
So habitat quality and disease are the two things that they're like smoking guns. This is what's going on.
Specifically, the study found poor body quality in caribou mothers in the herd. Hune says that suggests the caribou are competing for a special resource.
We know that the lichen community in the area is not as good as it used to be. There's like encroachment from woody shrubs, you know, as we start getting warmer summers and things like this, warmer winters.
Biologists also recorded epidemic levels of brucellosis, a disease that can result in late-term abortions and weak calves. The study found that brown bears were the primary killer of calves in the first 2 weeks of life. This May, Fish and Game undertook a month-long predation control mission, shooting nearly 100 bears and 5 wolves in the western calving area. The work cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, according to Hune. Tim Peltier, the area's regional supervisor from Fish and Game, says the department's goal was to boost calf survival.
So this intensive management action, that's a tool that the department can use immediately to try to reverse that declining trend.
The department aimed to salvage as many bear carcasses as possible and offer the meat to surrounding communities. Fish and Game's intensive management plan for the herd estimated approximately 50 to 120 bears in the caribou calving area, which means last month's predation measures eliminated the majority. Peltier says the department will monitor the effects of these measures.
We think by targeting one of the two calving areas, we should be able to detect change if predation is a big part of the problem.
The department did not report any immediate plans to address the herd's habitat conditions, but did note ongoing research on caribou forage areas across Alaska. There were also no reported immediate disease control plans. Peltier says that brucellosis tends to produce a short, temporary decline in herd population, not longer-term reduction as seen in the Mulchatna herd. But for now, biologists like Hune say that removing predators may ultimately further the spread of brucellosis.
So the predators aren't culling the sick animals, and so they're leaving more sick animals on the ground to infect more animals. So the sickness, the disease is spreading.
Subsistence hunting this season remains closed on caribou for the third year in a row. Caribou is a traditional food resource for many in the region. Alexander Talik-Palik has hunted caribou for subsistence in Leavelock, a community north of King Salmon. He says he's noticed the change in caribou migration.
They used to go through Leavelock or travel through the village for a span of 3 days.
Talik-Palik says he's noticed softer ground in the area, too. Now he hunts more moose, whose population in southwest Alaska has boomed in recent years, which some scientists say is due to climate change. Meanwhile, the Mulchatna herd numbers remain low, and the lichen population they eat continues to decline. In Dillingham, I'm Christina McDermott.
The 50-year-old State Ferry Columbia is out of service for at least a week for two maintenance issues, a bow thruster problem and leaking pipes. The ferry was scheduled to sail through southeast Alaska and to Washington State all summer. Now it's in the Vigor Shipyard in Ketchikan until at least June 28th. Sam Dapovich is a spokesperson for the State Department of Transportation.
The Coast Guard was on board the vessel. They inspected it. We make sure that our vessels are safe to operate. So that's the focus right now.
The Columbia is the largest of the state's mainline ferries. It stretches 418 feet and can carry nearly 500 passengers. Last week, the crew noticed leaks in pipes that carry salt water for the fire suppression system. Dapsevich says that's been an ongoing issue with the old ship.
They would fix one section, but then locate it in another section. So the permanent repairs that were made are good, but we found more rust in a couple other areas or more corrosion.
Then, while the Columbia was in Skagway on Monday, workers noticed one of the bow thrusters having issues. The part is needed for guiding the large vessel while docking. Ferry system managers decided to send the Columbia from Skagway to the Ketchikan boatyard with no passengers on board. Some passengers in Skagway were able to take another ferry, others had their trips canceled. All Columbia sailings through June 27th are canceled. Dapsevich says before the ferry can sail through international waters on its way south, the fire main pipes must be tested for pressure. After repairs, the ferry is scheduled to resume sailing to Bellingham, Washington on the 28th. This week, Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed $10 million in Alaska Marine Highway money from the operating budget that the legislature approved. Dapsevich says the veto is not shortchanging the ferry service. He says it was contingency money in case new federal funding came in low.
That veto was done so that they wouldn't tie up general funds on an unneeded contingency.
Dapsevich says if the expected federal funding does not come through, the state could use money from passenger fares to make up the difference. Voting is underway in the Alaska Artistic License Plate Competition, which is put on by the Alaska State Council on the Arts. Alaskans can now rank their favorites among the six semifinal designs on the State Council website. The semifinal license plate designs were selected by a jury featuring local elected officials and artists. Benjamin Brown is the chair of the Alaska State Council on the Arts. Brown says the council modeled the contest after artistic license plate competitions in other states.
Part of the whole beauty of the program is the visibility of the plate and seeing it and, you know, the art and celebrating the art on a moving vehicle.
The contest was created by the legislature in 2016, and a new bill that passed last year allowed the council to collect $3 per artistic license plate sold to raise funds for the council. Brown said that nearly as many people have already voted this year as voted during the entire 2017 competition. The ranked choice voting is open until July 31st, and the winner will be unveiled at the Alaska State Fair on August 26th. The winner will be awarded $1,000, and the other five contestants will receive $250. Among the semifinalists is Wasilla High School teacher Robin Lockwood. She says her digital media class worked on license plate designs, and her students encouraged her to submit her own.
I am not an artist by trade and still have a lot of, as I saw some of the artists who, you know, are my idols and people who I have their artwork up in my house, I am in disbelief that I'm even in the same category as them for this competition.
Lockwood plans to use her winnings in her classroom. Currently, Alaskans can choose from 27 different license plate designs that are available through the Department of Motor Vehicles. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, Christina McDermott in Dillingham, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.